Welcome, everyone, to the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. We have another packed agenda here today. I want to get to Senate Bill 809, but first we have to take care of some housekeeping issues, and I know many of you are here to watch that and participate, and I know Senator Starr is in the wing. So let's move some bills out of our committee that we now have the documentation for that prohibited from doing this the other day. Beginning with Senate Bill 215, I'd like to open up a work session on Senate Bill 215.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash to amend, or do you want him to? Okay.
Why don't you summarize the dash two amendments?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The Senate Bill 215, the dash two amended version specifically, prohibits the State Board of Education from the original bill prohibited the State Board of Education from adopting rules regarding use of mascots in public schools. The dash two amended version, which the committee is poised to pass out, will still the rule of the State Board of Education will be upheld, and the use of mascots will be prohibited unless they're in the situation where there's an agreement between a Native American or Indian tribal council or governing body and the school that wants to use those mascots, unless they've generated a document of acceptable use and the governing body has approved the use of that mascot in that specific school.
Okay, Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendment, Senate Bill 215.
Senator Cruz moves passage of the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 215. Discussion? Hearing none. Objections? Hearing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 215 as amended by the dash two amendments dated March 28, 2013 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 215 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, Senator Cruz?
Mr. Chair, I'll save my discussion for the floor.
Okay. Other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byers.
Aye.
Senator Cruz.
Aye.
Senator Rosa.
Aye.
Vice Chair Knope.
Aye.
Chair Hass.
Hass votes aye. The measure passes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation, and Senator Cruz will be the carrier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I will close the hearing on Senate Bill 215 and move to open a work session on Senate Bill 666. Councilor Donovan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 666 regards virtual public charter schools, and it allows virtual public charter schools to receive funding for funding, providing supplemental online courses. The dash two amended version that we're under discussion is related to the dash one amended version. The dash two's funds to operate programs under this provision emerge from the Oregon Virtual School District Fund, and the total appropriation now goes to the Oregon Department of Education, and it's for $5 million rather than $1.5 million every fiscal year. This measure currently has a two subsequent referrals, one to the Committee on Finance and Revenue, following that to the Committee on Ways and Means. The dash two amended version has been approved to go directly to Ways and Means, so we will rescind that, the existing subsequent referral to the Committee on Finance and Revenue.
Okay, so the bill has a shorter journey, but still goes to Ways and Means.
Still a long one.
We're in a work session, Senator Cope.
Chair Hass, I move to adopt the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 666.
Senator Knope moves to adopt the dash two amendments. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objection? Seeing none. So ordered.
Chair Hass, I move Senate Bill 666 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Finance and Revenue be rescinded, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Cadeau moves Senate Bill 666 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Finance and Revenue be rescinded, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The measure moves to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 666 and open up the work session on Senate Bill 600. Councilor Donovan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 600 directs district boundary boards to accept petitions from the city for a change in school district boundaries if certain conditions are met, particularly if the conditions regard a development newly incorporated into an urban growth boundary. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, we're in work session.
Chair Hess, I move Senate Bill 600 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 600 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none. Any objection? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byard.
Aye.
Senator Cruz.
Aye.
Senator Robyn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Knope.
Aye.
Chair Hess.
Hess votes aye. Senate Bill 600 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Byer, would you care to carry this? Thank you. And close the work session on Senate Bill 600. Thank you for your patience. I would like to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 809. Senator Starr.
Thank you. For the record, Senator Bruce Starr, representing Senate District 15, which is the communities of Hillsborough, Corneas, Forest Grove, and North Plains in Western Washington County. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 809. This is an important piece of legislation as it relates to homeschooling and homeschoolers in our state. Just real quickly, we've got some great folks that are here to testify on this bill, so I won't belabor it. But I would like just to remind us of the history in homeschooling in Oregon in a nutshell. Prior to 1999, homeschoolers were heavily regulated in our state, required to test every year, required to notify, always lived under the threat of remand to the public school system. In 1999, we were successful in moving legislation that Governor Kitzhaber signed that relaxed those regulations to the degree that homeschoolers live under today, where homeschoolers are required to test in grades 3, 5, 8, and 10, I believe. I believe that it's time that we continue the progress in relaxing the regulatory environment that homeschoolers and homeschool families live under today. The data is clear that homeschool families and children that are homeschooled perform extraordinarily well. These are families that are dedicated to the education of their children. You talk about personal attention. You talk about the opportunity to have one-on-one instruction, the opportunity to have a hands-on kind of instruction. This is the kind of class sizes that I think all of us would applaud across the state, and the dedication that homeschool parents have demonstrated and the sacrifice that they have demonstrated in teaching their children, I think ought to be applauded and rewarded. Again, the data is clear. The homeschoolers and homeschool families, by and large, score and do tremendously well. And I would ask for your consideration of Senate Bill 809. I would ask that you listen in closely to the testimony that you're going to hear from the advocates of this bill. And, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to testify and ask for your support in Senate Bill 809.
We thank you for coming down. Questions, Senator Byer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Starr, I'm reading through the bill real quickly here, and the only question I have is related to responsibility for transportation to and from.
To and from their home?
Yeah. I mean, I assume there may be odd hours, you know, as opposed to generally the districts are responsible for transportation, if the student lives a certain distance away. But those buses kind of run at set times. I suppose it would work to take them home because there's usually an athletic or an activity bus afterwards, but I'm not sure if they were coming in the middle of the day whether they...
So you're talking about homeschoolers that participate in interclassic
yes.
activities and
yes.
athletics.
Not to their classroom in their
yeah,
house.
So... my gut tells me that that transportation responsibility would lay with the parents. And if that's wrong, folks that are lined up to testify behind me will correct me. But I believe that that responsibility would be one that the parents would have.
Okay.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Okay. We do have some people signed up here. And so why don't I call up Dorothy Carmen, Jana Murray, Joyce Padilla, and thank you for coming forward. Welcome to the Oregon Capitol. Remember, if you have written testimony, we'll read it. You don't have to read it all to us. And thank you in advance for your brevity.
Thank you. Chairman Hess and the members of the committee, thank you so much for holding a hearing on Senate Bill 809 today. My name is Dorothy Carmen. I live in Portland, and I serve on the board of the Oregon Christian Home Education Association Network. You do have written testimony from me in your packet, and you also have a research packet that has been compiled by homeschoolers. In my written testimony, there's a couple graphs, and so I hope that you're able to see them. I probably should have brought a big display so it'd make it easier. But when homeschooling research is reported, graphically displayed, usually they display the median scores compared to the norming group. And in that research paper that you're looking at, you see a lot of those bar graphs that compare how home educators are doing to the norming group. On a standardized achievement test, of course, the norming group is the 50th percentile. Homeschool students in a variety of situations, their median score is above the 50th percentile. In my testimony that I handed you, I provided a small graph that showed a bar graph. And you'll note that the date on the data is 1998, which is somewhat, it's very dated, but it was the last available to us from the Department of Education website. After I turned the testimony in, just yesterday afternoon, we received more recent data from the Department of Education, and Roger Williams, who will be giving testimony in a little bit, will be presenting that to you. While comparing the median test scores of the norming group to the homeschool group, it's very informative. It's even more informative when we're able to break the data down to 10 percentile groupings. And in my testimony, you have a graph like this. The gray areas are what you would expect, the students you would expect from a normed test, 10% in each 10th percentile grouping. And the black bars are the homeschool test scores. Again, this was data collected by the Department of Education when we all homeschool students had to test every year. And you'll notice that the graph, as one of our board members says, looks like the wind is blowing heavily toward the high end as far as the test scores for the homeschoolers go. The interesting question that this graph raises is, where are all the students that we would expect if they followed the norming group on the low end? And the easy conclusion to draw from that is that they are benefited by homeschooling, and they are obviously testing higher than you would expect from a norming group. Joyce Padilla, who will be reading Dr. Brian Ray's testimony in a little bit, lists some of the possible reasons why. And the research report that I gave you provides the background for that. But I want to go back a minute to the children scoring on the low end. These are the ones for whom the test is that we take are very high stake. They are threatened to be put back in the classroom if they don't achieve a certain standard. They would be moving from a one-on-one teaching situation with their parents, the education tailored to their specific needs to a classroom where even though the teacher is the most caring and dedicated teacher, she cannot provide the same amount of attention that a parent can to that very needy student. In addition, I think especially those of you that have been in education would agree that a snapshot test, such as a either once a year or as we do now, 3, 5, 8, and 10 test, cannot tell where a student will learn the best just by taking a test score. That's true for the kids on the high end. Even though they're achieving on the high end, a standardized test just can't tell you what the best learning environment for that student will be. And especially on the low end, where the kids need the one-on-one attention, that snapshot test cannot tell you if they will do better in the classroom than they do at home. And because of the one-on-one attention they get, we and the personal caring, passionate parental involvement, all those things that that educators long for their students, you just can't get that in the classroom as much as you can in homeschool. In your packet, you have testimony from Deborah Keller. I won't read it all, but she sums it up by stating, homeschool testing for her family is an exercise in futility. Our 11-year-old son tested above the 12th grade level 2 years ago. We are currently evaluating whether to enroll him in homeschool college. There is no academic reason for him to take the 5th grade standardized achievement test. And I'd like to read Joyce Padilla's words that she gave us in full because it highlights the problem of achievement testing for those on the low end of the spectrum. Having homeschooled children, foster and adopted, that come from a family of drug and alcohol abuse, learning is most often at a slower pace due to the drug and alcohol effects. These children can learn and do learn, but process slower or differently than the norm. Testing at the grade level associated with their chronological age is often a challenge for them. For example, age-wise, the child would be taking the 8th grade test, but is academically at the 5th or 6th grade level due to his special needs. To mandate a given test, whether 3rd, 5th, 8th, or 10th, to a child of this nature only sends the message that they are a failure, when indeed they are the ones who have overcome so much. And Joyce summed it up when she wrote to us, the best method of evaluating our children's progress. I'm quoting Joyce again. As a parent, I see the progress that this child is making and his love for learning. Each year, he moves further ahead. The standardized achievement test is not a valid means of determining academic progress. And I ask that you release us from this mandatory testing for the sake of our children. Thank you for your consideration in this matter. I will be glad to entertain any questions you may have after my colleagues have a chance to testify, because I think they'll cover a lot of things. But I, too, want to echo what Joyce says. Please pass Senate Bill 809 for the sake of our children. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Haas and members of the committee, my name is Jana Murray, and I live in Jefferson, Oregon. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 809. I'm a homeschool mom, and I have children with dyslexia who have been negatively impacted by the current testing requirements. When I was homeschooled in the 80s and 90s in California, testing was not required. My parents still tested me to gauge how I was doing. I always enjoyed test day, and like all my friends, we always tested very high. So when my husband and I began our journey homeschooling our 6 children, it was different because 3 of our children have dyslexia, which tends to run in families. Through the years, we have seen learning specialists and completed extra programs on top of our regular academics. Our children have greatly benefited from the individual attention they have received. When they reached the 3rd grade, their reading level made testing very difficult and nerve-wracking. When I read the practice test to them, they did very well, but one of my children tested below the required percentage on the written test. This caused a year of unneeded anxiety and pressure for all of us. It distracted us from our regular academic program as we had to work on passing a test that she could not read. Thankfully, the following year, she tested high enough so we could continue to homeschool her using our own individual plan. My children's grandmothers both had dyslexia, and they graduated public high school at a fourth or fifth grade level in language arts and math. My mom was still able to homeschool me by utilizing homeschool classes, curriculum, and just her passion she had for my education. My husband, who went to public high school, had dyslexia and was put in a number of special classes which were not tailored to him. He was not helped academically and barely graduated high school. It was not until he completed a learning program in his 20s that he learned to read and study well. He's always been intelligent and amazing oral communicator, and he went on to graduate college with honors and a 3.9 GPA. If parents are taking the time and the energy to homeschool, you can be assured that they will competently address these learning issues. So please empower us to use our intimate knowledge of our children to help them to succeed without the distracting regulations.
Okay. I'm Joyce Padilla, and I'm here to represent Dr. Brian Ray, who was not able to be here. He's in Missouri right now. Dr. Brian Ray is an Oregonian, and he holds a PhD in science education from the Oregon State University. He's a certified teacher in the classroom, public and private, and a professor of education. He's been doing original research and following the research of others on homeschooling for about 30 years now. Dr. Ray is an internationally known expert on education in general and home-based education in particular, and here is his testimony. He says there are four main reasons why this bill is a good idea and should be passed. First, there's no empirical or research-based reason for the state mandating the students in this form of private education, homeschooling, be administered achievement test. Two major nationwide studies that include Oregon found no correlation between the degree of state control or regulation of homeschooling and homeschool student test scores. That is, not even a correlation or pattern of association. There must be at least a correlation for anyone to claim that there might be a cause and effect relationship between state regulation and test scores. There's not even a correlation. One of these studies included 5,000 students and another over 11,000 students. Second, homeschool students in Oregon and across the nation scored on an average 15 to 30 percentile points higher than their public school students. Study after study for 25 years by others and myself show this, and there are many important reasons why they do or do not do so well. Homeschool students do not score above average because states control them more or less. They do not score above average because their parents have or have not been state-certified teachers. They do not score above average because they have high or low incomes. They do not score well because homeschooling families get any tax dollars from their neighbors or the state. However, homeschoolers do very well on average because they get an individualized and customized education. Plenty of curriculum materials and learning cooperatives are available to them. They get a lot of one-on-one instruction. They have fewer distractions than in the institutional school. They experience a very small class size. Their schooling time includes a high proportion of academic engaged time, and they can master the knowledge and skills before moving on instead of being moved on because the material must be covered by the end of May. There is a lot of social capital involved in their education, and they have teachers who love them so much they will teach for free, no salary. The third reason that SB 809 is a good idea and that is that it is fair and more equitable than the current law regarding homeschooling. The current law penalizes parents and children who score below a certain percentile by potentially forcing the child to attend a public or private institutional school. It treats the parent and the child as failures and blames the homeschooling. If a public school student scores below the 15th percentile, and about 15% of them do, the teacher, school, parent, and child are not all blamed, and the student is not forced by the state to attend private school or homeschool. Nor are private school students and parents treated this way. Along this line, the state does not control and regulate the teaching, learning, and test scores of Catholic, Christian, Lutheran, New Age, and secular or atheist private schools and their students, parents, and teachers. Homeschooling is also private education and does not take tax dollars and should not be under the control of or be accountable to the state. The current homeschool law is discriminatory, biased, and unfair. Finally, the fourth reason is that there is intense national debate by scholars, educators, and policymakers about the wisdom and effectiveness of using test scores to control and try to improve teaching and learning in public schools. These people, based on mountains and decades of research, cannot even come to solid and valid conclusions about using tests to regulate public schools that are funded by millions of taxpayer dollars. With the ambiguity and constant debate in mind, it makes even less sense, actually no sense, to try to use testing and test scores to control and regulate private homeschoolers. There's no research to suggest such is a good idea, and furthermore, homeschoolers do not take a penny of money from their neighbor taxpayers. In conclusion, Senate Bill 809 should be promoted and passed for several very good reasons. It is based on research, and no research contradicts it. Second, homeschooler students do well academically for several obvious and sound reasons, and not because some law requires them to be tested. Third, this proposed law is much fairer and equitable than the current situation. Oregon homeschools today are treated by the state of Oregon as second-class educational choice, and this is done in a biased and discriminatory way with absolutely no bias basis. Finally, the public school world in Oregon and across the nation has no sound agreement on the value of achievement testing to control learning in tax-funded public schools. It makes no sense at all, and there's no research base to support the idea of using testing to control and regulate private forms of education called homeschooling. That costs Oregon taxpayers nothing and saves them millions of dollars every year. Dr. Ray concludes by saying he welcomes your communication with him, and I believe you have his information with you. Thank you.
We have that letter in our files. Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you.
Thank you.
Roger Williams.
Chair Haas, committee members, thank you for hearing this bill. I would like you to, Dorothy Carmans.
Roger, start off with your name, please.
Oh, pardon me, Roger Williams. I'm the I'm on the board of Ocean Network, the state homeschooling organization. If you could bring this graph back up from Dorothy Carmans. Okay. We'll talk about three things. First of all, the current law harms homeschool students. Second, the current law is based on a false assumption, which I will get into. Third, the implementation, the working out of the policy behind the current law is less than satisfactory. Okay, so those three. I'd like to echo what Jana said. My son was on the low end. I had a real high achiever and a low achiever. I wasn't teaching. It was differences between the students. And I'll make this part brief. A couple of the tests that he took, we had trouble keeping him above the 15th percentile. If you're not familiar with percentiles, the 50th percentile is half of the students would fall below that, half above it. So the 15th percentile, 14% of the students would fall below it. And if there were one more person up there, and this was from there were seven of you from a normal distribution of the population, one of you would flunk at the 15th percentile. No. So it's a fairly high range. We had to, and here's my point, we had to divert our attention from my son's long-term education in order to teach to the test, the stupid test, to get him passed that test so that he wouldn't be below the 15th percentile, and that's a penalty box for homeschoolers. One time, I'll just leave it at that. We had to harm our child by not investing in where he really needed it in order to get him to pass the test. And later on, he actually ended up developing compensating skills, and he was over a year ahead of his contemporaries later on in his education. It would have been a real shame to yank him out of his home school when he turned out like he did. So it's harming the kids at the low end. Anybody whose child is like scoring below the 30th or 25th percentile, they have to divert their attention to teach to the test, and that's wrong. Second, and this is where we get to the graphs. I gave you this, and I gave you Dorothy's, or Dorothy gave you a graph. This is from 1998, Dorothy's, and so the first thing we'd think is, well, that's outdated. How could that be relevant for today? And this is all of the available data from Oregon as of 2010-2011. We're still trying to get from the Department of Education last year's, but they haven't come to it. And I want you to, and Dorothy mentioned about the wind. This is, I don't know, when I look at this, I see it's like a brisk wind blowing leaves up against the wall. That's what it looks like. And I'm going to show you mechanically how that works. But I'm not going to use this one because this is so dramatic. I am going to use this one. Dorothy mentioned that according to national norms, homeschool students should be down in this group, should be up here. And the question, as she said, is what happened to all those students that should have been there? And by the way, this doesn't happen in any institutional school setting. This is I call this the homeschool effect. And I'm not going to go into why it happens, but it does happen. The statistics show it indisputably happening. What happened to these? Well, they obviously had to get higher scores. And in this case, some of them would go up one category, some of them would go up two categories, some of them even up into here. They're shoved by the homeschool effect they get a boost in their academic performance. But of course, that wouldn't be actually right, because we have to leave room for these students in the second group. And so it would actually kind of be like a layering effect, pushing those students to higher and higher achievement. Okay. Everybody knows that homeschoolers do well. So what's the point of this graph? Here's the point. And here's the flaw in the policy behind the current law. The current law assumes that a low achiever will do better in an institutional school. That's the assumption. That's what remand is all about. But this graph, and the one from 10 years ago, shows that even the students in the low range are helped by homeschooling. And there's no reason to believe that, I don't know of any combination of factors which would selectively improve the performance of these kids and not improve the performance of these kids. So these kids are still getting the benefit of the homeschool effect, even though they're at home in homeschool, even though they're low score. And what's the point of that? You're really hurting those kids if you take them out. And that's what remand is all about. That's what the current law is all about in its effect. In its effect, kids down to the 15th percentile, and actually below, because they're teaching to the test, and then the kids that are remanded, those who are, there aren't very many, but those who are, they are hurt also. And it's not only them, it's all the people who have to be in fear that they're going to, maybe something will happen 1 year or 2 years, and their child will be subject to remand. So there's fear of this remand throughout the homeschooling community for kids on the low end. Third point.
Mr. Williams, I need to ask you to conclude.
I will conclude. I will be done in 60 seconds. Only according to the figures we got from the ODE on this year, only 11% of students, homeschool students, are being required to have their tests. Actually, I would put it up a little higher because some of their figures on number of students is a little fuzzy. So, but I can surely say 85% the ESDs have figured out that it's not worth it for them to spend the funds, which could be used on the public schools, by the way. It's not worth their effort to track 85% of the Oregon homeschool students. And that's the failure of the policy. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Williams?
Mr. Chair, just a comment, and it's slightly off subject, but I'm going to use this as an opportunity to point out that teaching to the test is one of the major problems in our public school system as well.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Anyone else signed up here on 809? You have a letter from the Oregon Education Association. Lori, did you want to sign up and testify on this? Okay. So I will close public hearing on Senate Bill 809. And Senator Shields is here, so let's move to a public hearing on Senate Bill 828. Councilor Donovan, if you could give us a quick summary.
Sure. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 828 appropriates money from the general fund, the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, for the purpose of providing a fast-track training program in welding for Portland Community College. It also appropriates money from the general fund to the Oregon Department of Administrative Services for the distribution to Impact Northwest for expenditures related to that grant program. It generally concerns welding and welder training. There's a projected workforce shortage in welders, particularly trained car welders. There is subsequent referral to the Ways and Means, and the committee did just receive a fiscal impact statement that is going to be distributed to the dais right now. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Shields, you cleared out the room.
He's got that effect sometimes.
I've noticed that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate, District 22. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We hear a lot in this building about jobs bills, and this truly is a real jobs bill that has statewide significance. This is really the bill of a number of manufacturing companies here in Oregon. I wanted to read them to you. You should be getting this document that summarizes the program. This idea is supported by Vigor Industrial, HW Metals, SEH America, Everest, Leatherman, Esco, Leopold & Stevens, Enoch, Precision Cast Parts, Imperial Manufacturing, Daimler, and Gunderson Incorporated. And just eyeballing these, if I had to add up the total number of jobs here, I would say it's probably close to 8 or 10,000 jobs. But despite Portland still having a pretty strong core in manufacturing, and this being a place where Oregonians can still make a living wage, they're having an incredibly difficult time finding people who will be able to fill some of their job openings. Alan Sprott of Vigor Industrial was telling us how the workforce shortage has been so bad they've actually had to fly people in from Mississippi, put them up at hotels because they couldn't find enough talent here in Oregon in order to fill some of their welding positions. So what this bill does is it sets up a welding boot camp, most likely at Swan Island, which will be in close proximity to a lot of the living wage manufacturers on both sides of the river, west and east. And what's also important for all of you to know is the statewide significance of this is that the second part of the program focuses on building a pipeline, expanding Impact Northwest's Pathways to Manufacturing program that is currently in process at Centennial High School and Franklin High Schools in Portland, and expanding it out through pilot projects throughout the state. And that was very important to industry, so, because they felt like having a welder boot camp would not give them the pipeline of people coming in. So I think I'll leave it there and let industry and PCC speak more on behalf of this bill, but I am grateful that you took the opportunity to hear this, Mr. Chair, and if we would be grateful if you would then send it down to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Appreciate that. Questions for Senator Shields? Senator Roblin?
Good. Okay, we'll let you get back to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Put a name for a person in your
Okay, we got a couple panels here. Why don't we start with Dr. Howard and Bob Hanks, John Shaw.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jessica Howard. I'm the campus president of the Southeast Extended Learning Campus of Portland Community College. PCC is very happy to work with Senator Shields and with key industry partners like Vigor and Gunderson to launch this pilot project proposal to address immediate and long-term needs in Oregon manufacturing. The approach outlined here is one example of how community colleges can be highly responsive in addressing the need to fill middle-skilled jobs, which are represented by the middle 40 in the governor's 40-40-20 vision for the state. Specific to this proposal, we are committed to creating entry-level training for workers in the broad field of manufacturing through a flexible and effective model that we call the non-credit boot camp. In fact, PCC sent a team down to the Mississippi coast to review the Gulf Coast States Consortium's highly successful boot camp for ship fitters. This impressed us as a customizable model that would help us quickly respond to industry personnel needs and skill up our manufacturing workforce here in Oregon. Key components of the boot camp include a robust pre-screening and industry involvement from start to finish, from the development of specific competencies, including those related to welding, in the training, to job placement assistance. All of this we hope to be accomplished through our college's CLIME Center for Advancement, and I have the Executive Director, Bob Hanks, with me today. I'd like to turn it over to him so he can provide you with a bit of detail.
Okay.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, my name is Bob Hanks. I'm the executive director for the CLIME Center. The CLIME Center oversees a variety of different workforce training programs at the college. The proposed boot camp will focus on foundational and core manufacturing skills. We're relying heavily on a study that was done by WSI in partnership with industry partners to build this curriculum and utilize the data that they put together. The survey identified up to 30,000 manufacturing job needs over the next 8 years in the Portland area, with 12,000 new openings and the remainder due to retiring employees. The challenges in hiring are due to several factors: the changing nature of work, poor work readiness skills, the need for career training, and the decline of apprenticeship programs. Current workers also struggle with changing technology, and in many cases, manufacturing is not a career choice. As I mentioned, industry partners identified the most important skills as foundational and core. These include skills like soft skills, computer skills, safety skills, problem solving, critical thinking, communication, and the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. While there is some focus on specific occupational skills, the goal is to provide industry with employees that are immediately employable and will thrive in the manufacturing environment. We will also utilize a national career readiness survey to assess potential employees. The boot camp will also lead to industry-recognized certifications. We see this 10-week boot camp as a model that can be implemented throughout the state. And to talk a little bit more about specifics of the boot camp, I'd like to turn it over to John Shaw, who's an instructor for trades and manufacturing at PCC.
Thank you, Bob.
My name is John Shaw. I have been teaching in industry for approximately 40 years now, Senator Haas and committee members. I have a lot of experience of what the needs are in industry, what specific individual needs are, not only in the realm of soft skills, but in the realm of hard skills, and the matter of fact, in this area, specifically in welding, on welding site. Vigor Industries and Gunderson and a lot of other welding industries in the Portland area utilize technicians that have had some training in their backgrounds, but they also need to have actual lift up or an elevation in those training skill levels. The biggest issue gets to be that those technicians need to be fine-honed. They don't have the on-the-job skills necessary to absolutely perform in the workplace. They've been trained to a specific, if you will, and I hate to use the term trained to the test, but a lot of the public training around welding ends up being training to the test. Just boot camp will be entirely...
That's different, okay?
Yeah, I understand. But there's a industry certification exam by the American Welding Society that's been utilized for approximately 85 years as far as I know, and I'm a certified welding inspector. Those technicians are great at that 6-inch long weld. But we're talking about welding a ship together. You can't do it with a 6-inch long weld bead. It's not going to work. So that's what this boot camp's about, learning how to weld in industry, learning the soft skills to go with it, to be able to perform on the job, to be able to be a successful person in life. Thank you.
I guess my question is, why can't you do this now? I understand the need for extra money. Everybody needs that. But, you know, we try to show some restraint once in a while to let the institutions do what they should be doing. And it feels like this is something that you can do on your own. Maybe it's different than what Intel and Rock Creek campus do, but it feels to me like that, and they didn't need any extra legislation here. So maybe you could explain the dilemma you have that requires legislation.
This boot camp model is relatively new to us, and seeing what they did on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, which received a lot of press and which we also found out about through our partnership with Vigor. We are in the Vigor facility currently teaching our credit standard welding program. And so that's kind of the traditional model of churning out graduates on a credit track. This is a non-credit program that can be customized very, very quickly for whoever and whatever the needs are or are identified to be. And so as far as from our perspective, this is a relatively new approach to what may be an old problem.
That doesn't answer the question. Why do you need a change in law to do that?
It's simply an opportunity to provide a pilot program so that those who go into the program don't need to pay the cost to get in. It's an access issue.
The current training is basically, if you will, in the box. And it's basically accepted, and the curriculum is accepted at the state level and across the board. This is basically opening up to a new curricula entirely, and it's going to have to be run through BOLI and the various state agencies, Department of Education, of course, also. And there's nothing within the current structure to build that curricula, whether it be in welding or whether it be in machine shop or whatever, because we're dealing with an entirely different structure beyond what the existing structure is in place in the educational institution.
And I would add one thing, and that is it's through this kind of out-of-the-box, highly flexible approach to meeting industry needs that would then lead to career pathways and things that take probably 2 years to get through our institutional pipelines. This is about responding quickly.
So if this bill did not pass, you wouldn't move forward with this?
Senator Haas, we wouldn't have the current capital to move forward with the curriculum.
So if the money was there but not the language, you could start?
Yes.
So what are we changing in the language that is essential, I guess, is what it comes down to?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
You could do it with the funding, but not with the change in statutes.
Yeah,
maybe think we rely
Mr.
on
Wagner.
Yeah, sure.
He's more adept.
Yeah,
handling things.
Chair House, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Wagner, Government Relations with Portland Community College. This conversation was born during the interim out of a conversation when Senator Shields approached us after an event that he'd done down at Swan Island. He'd seen the opportunities, and in a minute we're going to have Gunderson, Vigor, we're going to talk about the other half of the bill. I mean, really, this is looking at what's happening with the mismatch of manufacturing positions that are available in this country and in this state, and how do we get people trained and into those jobs quickly. So if the question is one of resources, and I understand the restraints, I think that's a fantastic question to have down in Ways and Means in terms of balancing resources. I know probably all the committee members have competing interests in terms of ideas about things that we would like to spend, the state maybe be investing on. Our approach was in response to Senator Shields approaching us to sit at the table with Vigor, with Gunderson, with some of these manufacturers to come up with an innovative new pilot project that may be something new in Oregon, maybe something we could scale around the state, down in Coos Bay and in other places. So there really isn't anything in the language that's specific. We don't feel as a college or as an institution that we have any sense of ownership. What we want to be is somebody who can help pave the road to finding those opportunities for people into those jobs as quickly as we possibly can.
Well, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm the first one to say that our community college system is underfunded, and that PCC is one of our great institutions. I'm just still wondering why you just can't do this now.
Well, I mean, Chair Hass, members of the committee, for the record again, Rob Wagner. I think the question is one that the state doesn't fund career technical education programs sufficient to actually be able to invest in programs like this, quite frankly.
Right.
These are very cost-intensive programs.
So if you had the money,
you know, but if we had the money, I think we could scale the program.
Okay. All
right.
Senator Cruz?
A little bit off subject, because I know technology has changed. Is there much stick welding going on anymore?
Or no.
Okay. Well, I still do stick.
Don't date yourself.
Okay.
You're too late for that. Senator Roblin?
Well, out in the field, that's what you got to do, okay? You can't take a wire welder out
To Senator Hass's question, I guess my feeling is, as I look at this, generally we have pretended as if we were paying per student costs. We generally have just given lumps like lately, but we've always, it's been about earning a credit and how many credits and how many kids are in classes. This is a program which will have no credits earned at the end of it, as I read it. It will have some certificates, but it'll be a whole different kind of student that you're working with and is coming into this program, who yet currently there is no way to say there's a funding stream to fund it. Is that correct?
Chair Hass, Senator Roblin, that is correct.
Yes. And so as a pilot project, it's saying the community colleges can maybe offer a different kind of training, which has nothing to do with our curriculum and our credits and all those stuff. So we won't get any credit for it, except if at some point people decide that having a training sessions provided by community colleges might be another way of looking at funding people to get them up to the level they need to have to get a certificate. But to me, that's what I saw in this program, as opposed to what we do currently with community colleges. And so there is no funding stream other than if the companies came with the funding or if others did. And your proposal now is that these students would not pay any tuition. They would get this training for free, basically, from the state. Is that correct?
That's my understanding of the way that this program is established.
That might have to change at some point. But there's no tuition that they're being asked for.
Yeah, and you want to?
Yes, Jessica Howard again. thank you. A portion of this funding, a large portion, would be used for curriculum development. And so once that is there, you know, this is something that can be shared and should be shared around the state with the entrepreneurial arms of the of community colleges that deal with small business development and all sorts of contract training. So there is a place for it. It's just about getting it up and running quickly and in a way that is very, very responsive to industry needs that are changing constantly. That's one of the challenges we have at the community college and throughout higher education, is that it's the technology that we're chasing.
Right. And follow up on that.
Senator Roman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's my biggest concern, is this going to be a cooperative venture so that equipment will be given and donated or used by the corporations themselves? Because finding the kinds of welders we're talking about, they don't happen at my high school. I mean, every once in a while we get a chance to get a wire welding machine.
Well, there's wire welders and there's wire welders.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Senator Roblin, I can, John Shaw, I can address that almost directly. Most of, most of the welding manufacturers today have a practice of donating equipment to welding programs.
Oh, that's
at
good to hear.
No cost. You have to pay for shipping. You have to understand that. But in most all cases, they're very supportive of growing and developing welding industry state of the art. And that's what we're dealing with. Yes, there will be some support from industry. There'll be some support actually from the scrap suppliers. We have to weld on something.
Sure.
There's going to be support from the industry manufacturers and the suppliers. And I've already talked to several suppliers myself. They're very, very supportive of this program.
Why don't we hear from some of those members of industry that are here today? So.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sean Jillians, Caitlin Soss, and Polly Banks.
Me first? All right. I thought we'd have an expert first. clearly, I'm not. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Greenbrier Companies, the parent company of Gunderson Marine, in support of Senate Bill 828. I think you heard the folks from PCC and Senator Shields talk about the need that our folks see for qualified welders. We appreciated that Senator Shields came to us in the interim trying to look at creative solutions for how we could possibly enhance the workforce for our facilities, Vigor and Gunderson in particular. What you see today is a byproduct of that work group of what programs might be unique or different. How could we look at different outside the scope of what currently is done, because what currently is done is obviously not working. We have a severe shortage of qualified welders in our facilities. So I think, Mr. Chair, to answer your question of what this is an appropriation bill. I mean, this bill is, there's nothing in there that needs to change a statute for it. It's basically making appropriations in order to advance a proposal from PCC and advance another proposal at the high school level that's currently working, and I believe my colleagues can tell you more about the proposal that's currently working and where the funding is coming for that. With that, Mr. Chair, I just say thank you for the opportunity today. I'd be happy to answer any questions after they go through the rest of it.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Caitlin Soss, representing Vigor Industrials today. We have 1,700 employees operating along five shipyards along the West Coast, 600 of those on Swan Island in our Portland yard. Recently, we invested over $40 million to acquire the largest dry dock in North America to be right here in Portland. We anticipate 200 workers, plus workers, over the next 2 years coming in. With the shortage that you've heard about of skilled workforce, we came to Senator Shields and worked with him on this bill of programs that were able to respond quickly to that need, as well as programs that would continuously fill that need for workers over the next few years. To touch on a few of his points, currently we have 72 job openings. And to touch on his other point of us going to Mississippi, we have hired 42 contractors over the past few years from the Gulf states because we were not able to find workers in Oregon to fill those positions. So we are hopeful with not only PCC's program that will get those workers in jobs immediately, but also with the Pathways program that Polly will speak about, that those workers will provide a continuous stream of youth excited about manufacturing. And to touch on Senator Roblin's point of industry participation, Vigor does use our facilities to train those welders, as well as I personally know of a company down in Coos Bay that provides scrap metals to the Marshfield High School, and has done that for many years, and is very, very happy to do so, and has had several skilled workers. I know of one female that graduated out of that program, and the owner of that company says she's the best welder he has right now. So he's very thankful to Marshfield for those programs, and will continue to support Marshfield in those programs.
Okay. Hi, Chairman Haas and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Polly Banks, and I'm the director of the Pathways to Manufacturing program. I'm used to speaking to teenagers, so this is a different kind of audience. So.
Not really.
Thanks.
Go down a couple notches into there. So.
Should be perfect. Thanks. For the last decade, I've been working with and developing programs for high school students, and it hasn't really been since. I've never seen an audience like the students that I've had through this Pathways to Manufacturing program that have been so excited about the curriculum that we're offering through Impact Northwest. The kids are excited. They're engaged. They're seeing things and having exposure to industry that they've never had before. They are making the connections between the work that they're doing with their hands and in the class and the stuff that they love and what they can do with those skills in a career. I've heard from about half of the students in my class that the only reason that they go and attend school is because of these shop or manufacturing courses, which is a pretty scary thought. And I'm working primarily with seniors and juniors in this program, which makes me concerned about the students, the freshmen, the sophomore, the juniors that we haven't been able to capture and engage that are dropping out of high school because they don't have something that they can connect with. What the Pathways to Manufacturing program does is, overall, statewide, we want to increase the high school graduation rate. We want to increase enrollment in post-secondary institutions and training programs in order to develop a higher skilled workforce. Just in yesterday's Oregonian, there was an article about the skills gap and kids coming out of high school not being prepared to go into the workforce. And I'm not just talking about not knowing trade math, how to read a tape measure, those kind of things, but also the more competitive skills, the innovative thinking, the critical thinking, the collaborative thinking, teamwork, those kind of things, learning how to learn. And that's something that the Pathways to Manufacturing is teaching these kids. Another big component of what research shows as well is that in order for kids to really engage with school, they need to know why they're learning the stuff that they're learning. And what the Pathways to Manufacturing program does is we're partnering very close with industry. We've got an industry curriculum advisory committee, and this is members of, we've got ironworkers there, the Sheet Metal Institute, we've got members of Vigor, Gunderson, the community colleges, all at the table helping to inform this curriculum that we're providing for these high school students so that we're teaching kids to do what they need in that industry. So this is really something that is not happening at the schools, and I feel that these kids that have these brilliant kids that are creative and they're three-dimensional thinkers and they work with their hands, they're not receiving the opportunities and the direction and the options of going into careers in manufacturing or others that utilize the skills that they have. And in closing, I think that we owe it to them as educators, as parents, as citizens, Oregonians, to give them the options and the opportunities. And I think that's what this program, I know it's what it's doing now, but what we want it to do for Oregon, and that's it.
Questions? Senator Byer? Okay, thank you. Okay, if there is no one else to testify on Senate Bill 828, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 828. And I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 821. Some of you will recall that there was a conflict with an earlier bill from the House having to do with regulation of teachers, conflicted with private schools and Catholic schools. And the way we sorted that out was to start a new bill for them to ease that conflict. And so this is the new bill. Do you have a summary?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 821 allows private schools to discipline or to terminate school employees according to their own standards and policies, the policies of that private school. It requires the private school to comply with specified reporting requirements during those situations where they do terminate an employee. It declares an emergency effective 1st of July this year ahead of next year's academic year.
Okay, Roger Martin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I'm representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. And as Chair Haas pointed out, on March 12th, we presented similar arguments as an attempt to amend House Bill 2184. The chair of the House committee was concerned about a conflict, and we agreed with Representative Gelser. We didn't want to do anything to foul up her bill, which had already passed through the House. So I appreciate very much the committee introducing this as its own. You have my testimony. I'm not going to read everything. I just wanted to point out that this affects only private schools in Oregon. You should have, or hopefully got, a communication from the president of the Private School Association, who would have been here today, except he's in St. Louis. He solidly endorses the bill. I want to speak just for the 14,000-some kids that are in Catholic parochial schools here in Oregon. We're only asking for one exception to the law. All schools are covered by the ORS 339-370 through 400, as it has to do with sexual abuse or child abuse or sexual misconduct. And our only request is that we be allowed to follow a disciplinary process that is dissimilar from the public schools, only because we have established some very high standards. Every teacher that works, every school employee in parochial school has to take an extended class in how to report and what's correct, the entire subject area developed by a very high-level private company somewhere else in the United States. And they sign an oath. They're going to stick with that. And if they violate it, we don't want to have to go through the procedure of an administrative leave, paid administrative leave, and that's what this does. I want to point out we will continue to keep the records that are required by this law so that that dismissed employee does not end up somewhere else without records showing what the reason was. I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I guess my question might be, what guarantees are there that, in fact, that will be true, that the record-keeping provision is there and that your standards are indeed higher, and when we see this on a case-to-case basis? How are we supposed to go in and inspect?
Well, I don't have a detail of how they're done, but we are required by law currently to keep all those standards, all those records, and report them. And if someone applies saying that they had taught at, say, Central Catholic High School, those records are available.
Can you give us a hypothetical of where, without this change, there would be a problem?
The problem is that we end up with an employee who we discharge, we take off the teaching roles, but put them through a long process, or they have available to an appeals process. We have to pay them to do that while they're going through this process. I don't have details as to how long that takes, but the presumption to begin with was they knew exactly what the rules were, and they, if violation, they know to begin with, if they violate any of these rules, they're terminated.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I don't have any other people signed up on this, so we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 821. We will move to a couple of bills here by our colleague. Do you want to go down there?
I will do that.
And I will open up a concurrent public hearing on SJR 4 and SB 211. Perhaps you can give us a quick summary, Counselor.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 211 provides that the State Board of Education shall consist of 11 members appointed by the governor to represent kindergarten through grade 12 community colleges and institutions of higher education. It directs the State Board of Education to appoint a superintendent of public instruction. It abolishes the State Board of Higher Education and Higher Education Coordinating Commission. It transfers the duties and powers of the board and commission to the State Board of Education. And the Senate Joint Resolution 4 is the corresponding rules resolution that enables Senate Bill 211. Senate Joint Resolution 4 is necessary for the enactment of Senate Bill 211.
Okay, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, which is parts or all of Douglas, Coos, Curry, Jackson, and Josephine counties. If you remember, Mr. Chair, a couple years ago, we made a significant change in education in this state. We passed legislation to make the governor the superintendent, and then we created the Oregon Education Investment Board. A very dramatic change, and so we kind of looked at it and kind of took a wait-and-see attitude as to what would transpire. Mr. Chair, I have some concerns with what I am seeing at this point in time. And the first off, let me say, you know, one of the things we did was we removed a vote of the people without asking the people whether we should remove a vote of the people. And the things like that I always find troubling. But quite honestly, it was a pathway of least resistance for us because what we could do statutorily. However, I, in all due respect to the governor, I don't think the governor is the right person to be the superintendent of public instruction. Now, he obviously has the ability to hire people, and he has done that. But we're still the problem we have with the current structure of education is it's mostly political, and the lines of accountability are still relatively muddled, in my opinion. I look at education as being the biggest business in the state of Oregon. And so based on that, I looked at how other major businesses run their operations and to see if there's a better way to deal with administrative function of a major corporation. And most major corporations, you will find they have an incredibly competent board of directors, and that board of directors hires the executive officer to run the corporation so that there is a direct line of accountability from the CEO to the board. And so that's kind of the genesis of this proposal I have brought forward. I should also say at this point in time, I don't think either one of these bills is a completely finished product, and we are still having conversations about modifications to them. For example, the makeup of the board may be altered slightly, but the whole principle behind the makeup as it's currently configured, it's an 11-person board, 3 members representing OUS, 3 community colleges, and 5 for K-12, 1 from each congressional district, appointed by the governor, but appointed from a pool that those various entities will select. So based on that, one would assume that OUS would put forth their best people to represent them on this board. So the concept is we would have an incredibly highly competent board of directors to run education. Mr. Chair, I'm trying to get politics out of education. I truly am. I think education should be run by people who are experts in the system, and that isn't always what has happened in my 16 years in the building. What modifications we need to make are, at this point, still unclear. I've been having conversations with a lot of people in this building. And first off, let me say that this is no disrespect to the board members of the Oregon Education Investment Board. They are all good people, but they aren't necessarily experts in education. And I quite honestly think that it's time that education is turned over to the experts. Now, the provisions in the bill that what it eliminates underneath, I may modify that to a degree. My basic thought was, we will create this board. They will hire the best person they can find in a nationwide search to be the CEO of the enterprise. And that board and that CEO will determine what administrative structure they need to manage the system. I know that one of the desires in the creation of the Oregon Education Investment Board was to create a more seamless system. What I've seen so far is the creation of more bureaucracy. And I just think we're moving in the wrong direction. The reason I'm bringing this forward now is everybody hates change. Okay, we're in massive change right now. So the question is, are we making change in the right direction? It's my intent at the end of the day, if we can put this together right, is to offer the people of Oregon an alternative. We have what we created as a legislative body, and then we could send this to the ballot, and the people of Oregon can decide which direction they think is best for the state of Oregon. Now, I say that based on the fact that virtually every time the people of Oregon are asked a question, they usually come up with the right answer. And on an issue of this importance, I think sometimes it's better to take the discussion outside the building, other than the community meetings that we have. I mean, Ways and Means is about ready to go on their road show, which is pretty much a pro forma thing. And so community meetings don't necessarily always work. If we can get this on the ballot, I think it will engender a very robust discussion on levels that we don't normally get to, and at the end of the day, we'll come up with what I hope is a better pathway going forward for our education system. Mr. Chair, my father was on the Roseburg School Board for 20 years and on the State Board for 10 years. I haven't been as involved as Senator Roland, but obviously, I've been watching the progress of the system for a long period of time. I do agree that change is necessary. I just want to make sure that the change we're doing is moving in the right direction, and I humbly believe that this is a better way than what we're doing now. So, Mr. Chair, we have work to do yet on these. I will have a conversation with you after as to what I hope what our plans will be for the bills, and I truly appreciate you hearing them, and I will answer any questions.
So we have the two bills here. One is a referral.
Right. And, Ms. Chair, we may end up making the other bill a referral, too. That's one of the things we're still debating. So, which would be another bill, but I still have priorities left, so that could happen.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Lindsay Capps from the Oregon Education Association.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to come address you today on these bills. I'm here to offer our organization's comments on Senate Bill 211 and Senate Joint Resolution 4. I'm sorry?
Who are you?
I'm Lindsay Capps with the Oregon Education Association, for the record, Chair. And again, thank you. We're very encouraged by Senator Cruz's leadership in creating an opportunity for the legislature as an oversight body to evaluate and address the alignment of key governance structures in our public education system. I think we're all coalesced around the goal that we need to move toward college and career readiness for all students, as has been identified under 40-40-20. We need to do that by 2025. That's obviously going to require, as this committee has engaged in a lot of dialogue around, the integration and the seamless integration of the K-12 and higher education sectors. I think for us, we understand, and I think you all understand as policymakers, that for us to bring these two sectors together is going to take a sustained effort to build consensus around the strategies to make each and every student successful throughout the learning progression. A concrete example of this happens to be around the collaboration between teacher preparation programs and K-12 school districts. Preparing teachers of tomorrow to excel in the vastly changing environment in public education with new educator effectiveness systems in school districts, implementation of Common Core standards. As the panel you had on Tuesday was talking about diversifying our workforce within the teaching profession and focusing on cultural competency to help each and every student succeed, this will depend on higher education and K-12 leading together. We think Senate Bill 211 provides a clear and promising concept of how cross-sector decision-making can be facilitated and linked in a meaningful way to implementation and partnerships on the ground. As we look at the existing structure of governance boards in the 40-40-20 context, decision-making remains disparate, and the ongoing purpose of these boards still requires further definition, as Senator Cruz pointed out. We're also encouraged by the inclusiveness of this legislation in creating, for the first time, a formal place at the table for frontline educators in key decision-making impacting our P-20 public education system. As you will all remember, the legislature actually passed legislation to do this within the state board context in 2009. It did not get the governor's signature at the time. So I think that principle has been established by this body in the past, and we think you ought to follow through on that. As someone who's leading our organization's Center for Great Public Schools, one of our key pieces of work is really working in partnership with ODE, COSA, the Chalkboard Project, and others in the development of teacher and administrator evaluation systems. And what we've seen from that process, which is involved teachers and administrators, school leaders really engaged in deep thinking about this work and how it impacts student learning and effective practice, is that the voice of expertise of educators is really critical to our success. And the same is true in the work that's happening under the OEIB, under Achievement Compacts, where those who have a daily stake in the work, educating our kids, are directly involved in developing key strategies and practices to meet district-level goals. As we have worked, as our center has worked to bring administrator teams together with teacher and staff teams to develop these compacts, we've seen firsthand how shared leadership and collaboration can strengthen our schools by building ownership and buy-in at all levels to develop sound strategies to move successful implementation forward. But we're concerned that this collaboration isn't just limited to evaluation tools or compacts, but it can be transformative in developing solutions for a number of issues across our educational system that are critical in our ability to meet 40-40-20. And this collaboration and leadership ought to be reflected not just in local school systems, but at all levels of government governance, not just in the implementation, but also in the design of system-wide policy and strategies. And this bill provides an opportunity for frontline educators to be a part of that conversation. And as I think has been noted, that opportunity currently doesn't exist at the highest level of our state system. So we'd like to see that change, and Senate Bill 211 provides a clear and promising remedy to engage educators, their expertise, and that of other important stakeholders, not just educators, to deepen the capacity of the system to meet our statewide goals for student success. So we look forward to the opportunity to work with the committee and a continuing dialogue around this legislation, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Lindsay. Questions on this? Okay.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, and I don't see anybody else signed up to testify on either one of these two bills, so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 211 and SJR 4. And that seems to clear our agenda of 8 bills here today. I know it's quality over quantity, but that was a workload. So if there is no other business before us, we are adjourned.